Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. With me today is Jason Brennan, who's a supervising sound editor and re-recording mixer at Warner Brothers Studios right here in Burbank. But first, let's talk about some of the new YouTube features. Now, YouTube is really important for every musician, artist, band. If you're in a music business, YouTube is a big part of your income, or it should be, and also of your exposure to the public. YouTube is now the number one place online where people find new music. And also, the younger you get, the more you use YouTube to find any kind of music. So now it's really important as a distribution network, and it's something that you always have to be aware of. So any kind of new features is a big deal. Well, they've come up with a number of new features. And the first thing is what they're calling Creator Studio. And Creator Studio is just a way for you to manage your YouTube account via your smartphone. So you can access the video manager and all the analytics and basically keep track of what's going on without having to access it through the web. Now, I'm not a big fan of apps in particular, but this actually might be something that's really good and might be very helpful. But that's not the only new features. There's plenty of new ones besides Creator Studio. One of the cooler ones is an audio library that also has sound effects. The cool thing about this is if you want to use some cleared music and you want to use some cleared sound effects, they're right there in the library. So you don't have to worry about stealing anything, about worrying about licensing, none of that stuff. And that's the good part about having that library available. Another cool feature is it now does 60 frames a second. So if you want really good high-end video, and again, we're moving up to 4K pretty soon, they're gearing up to have 4K or high definition, if you want to look at it like that, they're gearing up to have excellent high def, super high def resolution available to you. Another very cool thing is something they call creator credits. And what this is you can have a list of all the people that worked on a particular video, but there'll also be links, interactive links, that you can actually go to the pages or go to the YouTube sites of those who helped you. And that's kind of cool. They're also going to have an integrated fan funding feature as well. So for people who have big followings and want to kind of progress beyond the advertising model, you can ask your fans to help you create a new video, to patronize you with Patreon. All of that is now possible, so that's kind of cool. Another cool feature is subtitles, but from fans. So you can get your fans really into what you're doing by allowing them to subtitle the video. And actually, it's user-generated content, but you're generating it first, and they're more or less manipulating it a little bit. But it's also a bit of social commentary, and that's kind of cool. We're not finished there. Now they're also going to have something called interactive info cards. These are basically annotations, but it's a faster way to do an annotation. Anybody knows that right now you have to build an annotation, and it can take a while. And once again, you spend all this time creating this video, and then when you actually launch it on YouTube, there's a lot more work involved. So for instance, you probably want to add a really good description, tags are important, all those things, and then you figure, okay, I still have to put annotations in to really help the viewership find more information if they just want to click on the video. Well, this will be an easier way for them to get that information. So that's the interactive info cards. Look for the new YouTube. If it doesn't have these features now, it's going to have them soon. And again, very, very useful, very cool. Next thing I want to talk about is Ben Folds' studio in Nashville. And probably by now, most of you have heard about this. Ben Folds has been renting out RCA Studio B in Nashville, and Studio B has a long, long history of having these major artists work in it, and hundreds of artists that go way back from Waylon Jennings to Roy Orbison to even more current artists, Keith Urban, Bob Seger, Carrie Underwood, list goes on and on. It's a historic studio, but it's not a historic site, and now the owner of the building wants to sell it. And this would be another case of a grand old studio going away, becoming a parking lot. Because actually, the new owner wants to turn it into condos. So this is kind of a shame. And Ben Folds is trying to get the Nashville music community behind him to declare this a historic site. He's running up against some resistance, actually. One of the reasons why is the owner of the building, the owner of the studio, is the great Harold Bradley. Harold Bradley and his brother Owen Bradley and Chet Atkins actually created the modern Nashville music scene. If it wasn't for them, none of that would have existed. They started all this, and they started the RCA Studios, and the Bradleys have owned it forever, and they've actually been trying to sell this property for 20 years. And only now have they gotten the price they want. Now, Ben Folds says he can't buy it because they want $4.4 million, and they think the property's only worth $2.4 million. He claims he just doesn't have that kind of dough. Now, he's kind of a B-range artist, so he's doing well enough to be able to rent this studio out, which probably is a nice penny. But the fact is, he's not doing well enough that he's in the upper echelon of earners in the music business. This is a little too rich for his blood, so to speak. Now, what's been happening in Nashville for a long time is that when some of these famous studios come up for sale, rather than developers buying them and turning them into condos or mini malls or whatever, Mike Curb has been buying them up and then donating them to Belmont College. He's done this a number of times. He's already done this with RCA Studio A in Nashville. He's done it with Ocean Way. He's done it with the Quonset Hut and I think a couple others that I can't recall right now. But anyway, he's bought these grand old studios, these grand old buildings that have all this history, and he's donated it to the school. And the students down there use these studios every day, which is very cool. We don't know if he's going to do it in this case, because once again, it seems like they want an awful lot of money for this building, and they want way beyond what it's worth, what it's assessed for. So who knows how this is going to turn out. One of the things that it does point out, though, is that this has happened over and over in the last 20 years. These great studios that we know and love have gone away. You can look in New York and Nashville and London and L.A. and find all sorts of examples, which, you know, it brings a tear to the eye when you really think about it. For instance, the historic Columbia 24th Street studio, which is supposedly one of the best sounding rooms in the world. Well, that's gone. Gold Star out here in L.A. has been gone for quite a while. The Hit Factory in New York. Wally Heider is out here in Los Angeles. Enterprise, which was a big studio in Los Angeles as well, actually here in Burbank, Trident Studios in London, and we can go on and on and on. And unfortunately, these historic studios, the real estate is worth more than the studio is. So that's what's been happening. It's just too expensive to have a big facility like that that isn't actually earning that much money in the grand scheme of things. So what ends up happening is the owners decide that they're going to make money with what they own. And you can't much blame them about that. But the real problem is, of course, that we have these great studios and with the great history. And not only that, the great sound. So many of them are going away. Luckily, there's still a few around here in L.A. There's still Capitol Records. And that is a historic site. So it looks like that will maintain for quite a while. We have Ocean Way still here in L.A., which used to be United Western, and that was just bought by Gower Studios, big film studio, so no one knows what's going to happen with that. Of course, there's Record Plant that's still here, although it's not the original Record Plant. It's been at a different location for quite a while. So these do exist, and we can only hope that they continue to live a long and fruitful life. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. That's questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is Jason Brennan, who's gone from being one of my assistants a really long time ago to to cutting and mixing television shows at Warner Brothers. Jason does everything from cutting dialogue and music to recording ADR and effects to mixing the shows. I caught up with him in his studio, which is appropriately located in Studio City, California. Hello, Jason. Welcome to my podcast.
Hello, Bobby.
And it's really nice to actually be on location for a change. We're here in Jason's studio in Studio City, right?
Studio City.
Yeah, cool. And Jason and I used to work together a long time ago, and then he went off to be a post guy.
Yep.
So tell us that journey. How did you go from being a music guy to a post guy?
Well, I think it was more the, you know, just the industry was changing a lot. You know, a lot of studios were starting to close down. Work was very thin. And through Euphonics at the time, they called me up and said, there's a post house that's putting in two brand new System 5s. They need a chief engineer over there because they don't know what they're doing. And they're tired of getting phone calls. So I went over there and helped them put all their consoles in and get everything up and running. I think I actually even called you for something with the DA98 because there was that weird menu in that clock.
I remember. That's right. Yeah.
And
that's going back a ways.
Yeah.
When you talk about DA98s.
Mm-hmm. Because everything was still at that point in time in 2003, everything was still being delivered mostly on DA98s.
Yeah.
As opposed to files.
Well, you were a real whiz, and you probably still are on the Euphonics. I mean, I've never met anyone that had quite the acumen as you on that.
Thank you.
Not only did you know it, you were fast. So that was very cool. Okay, so then you went and you became a chief engineer at this place. And that was doing mostly film or television?
Both.
It's both. Okay.
It was both. They did a lot of movie of the weeks and you know, had a lot of, you know, independent feature films that would go through there.
Okay. So how did you get to Warner Brothers then?
It was kind of more of a falling out with the facility I was at, you know, at the time. You know, it was kind of where the market crashed and everything, and they made like pretty major cutbacks. And so it was just kind of felt like it was time to leave. And I had contacted a supervising sound editor, a friend of mine named George Simpson, who's going to kind of help me get out and get into some, you know, some union places, because I had all the hours that I needed to really get in the union. And then like literally a month later, he passed away, had a heart attack. Mm. So it was kind of getting, you know, my name out to some of the other studios. And basically I was working on this movie called Faster, just kind of cutting. And I got a phone call from a friend of mine at Warner Brothers, said that there's this Showtime television show called Shameless that wants somebody that can edit, supervise, and mix the entire thing.
Wow.
So I met with Bill Angarola, who was the vice president of post-production over there. Then met with the producers and basically auditioned for it. They said, you know, take 10 minutes of the pilot and build it. Let's see what you can do. Mm-hmm. And I ended up doing 17 minutes. I ended up doing like an entire, like two acts, I believe. I edited all the dialogue, cut all the effects, cut all the backgrounds, you know, cut the music that was in there, and then mixed it down in the underground there. And they came in and was like, this is great. Did you listen to the, you know, the pilot that we had? And I'm like, nope. And they were like, oh, great. And then that was it. I kind of just started from there. So I ended up pretty much for the first two seasons, I was the supervising sound editor. I cut all the dialogue. I cut all the music. And I mixed all the, mixed everything by myself in a room smaller than this.
Wow.
In 5.1.
And this is about, what, 12 by 12?
Yeah, something like that.
14, something like that, yeah.
So it was just a tiny, tiny little room. And John Wells would come in for the playbacks and literally sit probably even closer to me than you are, because it was, you know, it was a little wider than like a 24 channel D command.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
And it was, you know, I had the Avid Unity that was running the picture. So it was coming right off of their cut.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's
cool. So if they'd make picture changes, I'd have immediate picture and I would conform everything. And
yeah.
And that's how it would go.
So what are you doing now there? I know you have expanded roles there.
You know, after the third season, you know, I think they wanted to go back more to like a traditional style mix where they were on a bigger dub stage and, you know, two different mixers. And so, at that point, it was getting pretty tough to you know, follow their schedule. And it was only like 3 months. So, you know, the original associate producer had contacted me about, you know, filling in on Suburgatory, which is the pilot I did, you know, because the supervisor that I gave it to, his father passed away. And then I ended up coming back on as a dialogue editor and then transitioned back into supervising for that show. And then picked up another show called The Fosters, which is on ABC Family. And now starting up this pilot that I got picked up for ABC called Selfie.
Okay.
And so at this point, I'm just supervising and supervising and cutting dialogue on The Fosters.
So for those of you who are listening, could you tell people what music supervising is? Because there's probably some people there that don't...
Well, this is there's a difference between music supervising and supervising sound editor. You have a music supervisor who is kind of in charge of all of what music gets put in and licensing, you know, budget, you know, and things like that. And they typically have a music editor who kind of cuts everything together with whatever needle drop stuff they've brought in or, you know, score. And so he'll kind of cut it and arrange it. And so I'll deal with everything else in terms of sound, the dialogue, the ADR, the group, the sound effects, the backgrounds, the Foley, and make sure that all of that gets put together, that my crew has the notes that they need, you know, if they, the executive producers want something specific, they know what to do, you know, so I'll hand it off to them and they'll either, you know, they'll cut something specific or, and I usually have them cut more than one thing. So we have options on the stage.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once we're done, you know, we'll shoot the ADR, shoot the group, go to the stage and we'll mix it and, review it with the executive producers.
When you're supervising, does that mean that you can't do any of the other jobs?
No. I mean, as it went on Shameless, you know, I was, you know, the supervising sound editor, but I was also the re-recording mixer, which turned into the title Supervising Re-Recording Mixer.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So, I mean, in, you know, there's, it's what they call mobile mixing. It's not a traditional dub stage with, you know, $2 million console and, you know, giant speakers. They'll literally put you in a room somewhere if the client's off, you know, off lot and they want you to mix there. They'll put in an Icon and, you know, a Nearfield 5.1 and you'll mix, you know, off site.
No kidding.
Yeah. And that's, so they call that mobile mixing, which some people like, some people don't. You know,
it's a different environment.
It's just
every
a
time.
Very different environment, you know, and it's a lot more stressful too because you're having to deal with, you know, if you're dealing with picture changes or, you know, wanting to make sure that, you know, I would, with Shameless, I would leave the room and go to the ADR session sometimes to make sure that I was getting the performances I wanted to hear and matches that I wanted to hear that sometimes weren't always being delivered the way it was like, oh, why didn't they do it? Like, why did they only give me two?
Yeah. Out of those jobs that you mentioned supervision, you mentioned dialogue cutting, music cutting, ADR, you do ADR as well?
Yeah, ADR, and, ADR editing.
And then re-recording.
Right.
What's the toughest job out of all those?
I would probably say mixing, just because, you know, the time frame that you have to get everything, you know, accomplished, you know, with like a feature, you'll have time to pre-dub stuff, you know, so you'll get the dialogue and you might have, you know, 2 weeks even to go through and pre-dub all the dialogue, pre-dub all the ADR before you even get to the final
pre-dub
mix.
Pre-dub meaning pre-mixing.
Pre-mixing it. Yeah. So then you get to the, you know, you get to put your reverbs on, try with a couple of different things, to kind of get a really nice and better sound. And, you know, with film, you go to the dub stage and then with your effects, you know, mixer who's done the same thing. And then you start to hear how it all kind of blends together. You know, is the effects too loud? Is, you know, and then you start adding the music in at that point. And usually the director or the picture editor will be there to kind of help direct where they want the sound to go. But in television, like on a typical 1 hour drama or something like that, they have like 1 9-hour day to get through the show and one day to pretty much finish it and review with the client. So there is no pre-mixing time. It's pretty much live. And track count is still pretty, you know, probably not as wide, but it's still pretty wide. You know,
meaning what?
Well, you know, feature may have 32 tracks of dialogue, you know, with all the different alts and stuff like that, and, you know, lots of different group. You know, effects could be 1,000 tracks, like on a movie like Transformers has 1,000 tracks and, you know, 10 playback systems for Pro Tools systems just for the effects.
That's amazing.
You know, so it's a lot to go through. So, you know, having to, you know, like with an effects editor or effects mixer, they have to mix the Foley, the backgrounds, and the effects all live. And if it's a heavy action show, you've got, you know, car chases, gunshots, car crashes, you know, people running, the backgrounds, usually you'll take those down because they're not that important when stuff is going. But, you know, you have to be able to blend all that in a relatively short amount of time. So TV can be a little tougher in that respect, just because you got to know what you're doing and be able to get it done quickly so that it doesn't sound bad.
One of the things that I found when I was producing television was when we'd hire shooters, cameramen, in other words, all the film guys would take forever to put it together, and they'd obsess over one light, and the TV guys would come in and get it done, and it was run and gun, and okay, this is going to work, boom, done.
Right.
And they were a pleasure to work with because they just got to it, while the film guys just lollygagged around until they got it and would stop in the middle of a take because the light isn't where they want.
Right.
You know, crazy stuff like that. So I appreciate television people because they're doing it on a different schedule and at a different rate.
Yeah, and you know, there's, you know, a lot of the shows are up against air dates.
Yeah,
and you know, has to be delivered, has to be QC'd. You know, because once we deliver it, you know, finally it goes to, you know, QC house, who checks picture for, you know, any little, you know, problems and listens to the audio.
Is this external to Warner's?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. They have, you know, they have places that specialize in doing, you know, quality control, you know, and making sure that, you know, there was no dropouts, there's no ticks, you know, checking the M&E stem for, you know, English, that all the you know, the Foley props are there, so, you know, that's covered when they do their foreign versions. And so, yeah, it goes on a half-hour show, you basically, from the time they turn over the picture, you have about 4 days to turn it all over before we final it and ship it off.
Wow.
So it can be a pretty quick turnaround.
Wow.
You know.
Well, how does it work then during the season? When do you get shows in relation to when they're going to air?
All depends on the network. You know, the major networks like, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, you know, they always, you know, kind of start premiering stuff in September, and they have, you know, two halves. But, you know, AMC, you know, they have blocks of like, you know, 3 months, and they split it up. Showtime and HBO have just 3 months, 12-episode blocks, where, you know, January through March is Shameless, and then comes another series like, I don't remember, like Ray Donovan might be, you know, April through, you know, end of June, and so they do it in quarters.
Yeah,
you know, so it all just depends on those schedule. You know, HBO tends to want to get everything done really soon before they start airing it. That's just how they operate. Mm-hmm. So others, you know, might be, you know, chasing air dates. You know, so it all just kind of depends on the producer, the network, and what their style is.
Let's talk about cutting dialogue for a second. I have several friends that cut dialogue, and they complain to me about how much work that they have in comparison to the time that they have and how generally bad the dialogue recording is. Have you run into that?
Yeah, there's been definitely some bad recordings, and I typically, when I get things, if there's a problem, I'll communicate that with the associate producer. Hey, there's a problem here that I'm noticing. So they can tell the, you know, production sound mixer, hey, you're distorting. You know, I've had guys that, you know, over-modulated or blew, you know, right into the mic pre that just, and so they're not listening, you know, so it's like they have to, you know, I like to get that, you know, off as soon as possible. And typically they're already 5 episodes in by the time I get to hear it. All right, I got 5 episodes I have to deal with. Hopefully they figured it out in, you know, the second or third episode. I think a lot of the technology is getting better in the way that it's getting a little bit better. But with television, they're shooting so fast that you do get noisy stuff because, you know, they don't have the time.
Yeah.
You know, they're on location at this spot for 2 hours and that's all the time they have. So, you know, getting the shots they want, getting the booms in. So yeah, I mean, it can be, you know, it can be a lot of work, but I think, you know, the old, and I know I get, kind of dagger eyed looks from other, you know, editors. I don't edit traditionally. I edit it in a completely different way because I had to figure out a different way when I was doing Shameless to get it done in time.
Okay, so what's the traditional way?
Well, the traditional way is like they, you know, they take one scene, they go through and they listen to every single mic, and then they pull it up into their bench tracks, and you know, they go, you know, through every little, you know, little bit, and then they start, you know, spending time finding fill, and you know, they, you know, they typically, some people can edit anywhere from 6 to 10 minutes a day, and you know, generally what I found is in that traditional way is there's leaves so little time to cut alternates, and so you know, that's the one thing that I've just nobody likes ADR. So if you've got, you know, 100 lines of ADR, but 90 of them could have been, you know, eliminated through, you know, alts or, you know, just, you know, cutting, then it would just, you know, everybody wants production. So I think it's just, it's the approach. That's the approach that they've learned, and that's the approach that they, you know, have. So with Shameless, it was like, I got to get this done quicker, you know? So I started just basically, I would go through all the mics first and decide, you know, what I'm going to use. Mm-hmm. And rather than copying it out of my assembly, I would just drag it up. So I knew whenever I'd look at my assembly, what I've used.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I never have to like read the, you know, what mic it is. Oh, that's the lav on George. And then down here, oh, I've used that. So I can already see it from just a bird's eye view. And
that would make a lot of sense. I don't see why anybody.
It's the way people different. Have been taught to do it like that. And so, but I'll go through all the mics first. And generally, if I, you know, find that the boom sounds nice and works, then, you know, I'll bring, you know, I'll just keep listening to the boom until I find a problem. And then, you know, if there's a problem, I'll, you know, either one, see if I could fix it and just bring in an ISO if it's available to, you know, maybe blend or, you know, work with that, you know, can be, you know, added in. So, you know, I'm not listening to every single mic. I'm finding what sounds best first. Start with the booms. If they're too noisy, then I go to the lavs.
Yeah. Okay. So when you say that you're going to listen to a boom, and if you find something that doesn't work, then you'll try one of the other microphones. What would that be? What would a typical problem be?
Noise. Like if they're in a noisy location. There was one scene on the Fosters. They shot by, you know, just it must have been lunchtime or something, but there was just cars. And so when you cut, you know, from different takes, you get a car starting to come and then it's gone.
Yeah, right.
You know, so, and depending on the actor, some actors are really religious to what the script says and others kind of say things differently every time. So they're harder to find alternates for. So I ended up having to do quite a bit more ADR on that than, you know, than normal, just because, you know, I couldn't really blend a car coming across the mic. And the ISOs had the same problem. So
is it up to you to decide what kind of ADR? Do you go back to the producer and
no,
the
director? No, I decide on pretty much what the ADR is. That's what, you know, my job is to decide what needs to be ADR'd and what I can get, you know, get away with by cutting alts.
Yeah.
But, you know, by going through, you know, my method, it allows me, because I make notes on every single problem. It's like, hey, that's an overlap. Let me look for an alt for it. And sometimes it's like, if it's missing an S, I'll find an S at the end of a completely different word just to finish it off so you don't have the overlap.
Yeah.
You know, rather than bringing the actor in.
Yeah.
You know, and so it takes, you know, maybe a day to go through and arrange everything and cut all the alts. But then once it's done, it's quick editing. All I'm doing is editing. And it's, you know, the mind flow, the mindset of, you know, doing one task and then going to another task and then going to another task and then starting over again I think it just slows you down. It's like if you, you know, if you build the foundation first, you know, like build half a foundation and then start pouring the rest of the foundation, your mind is in that and your ear is listening to that. So when you're listening to noise and problems, you're focused on that. You're not focused on what the edit is doing.
Yeah.
So when you get into editing, all you're doing is editing. You're not having to think about all those listening things that you have to do.
Because that makes a lot of sense. Again, I don't see why you'd cut any other way.
That's traditionally how it was done, and that's why I can get through a show very, very, very quickly and very efficiently. And when we go to the stage, there's maybe at one time, you know, do we have a, you know, oh, there's a bang that I missed, or, yeah, you know, this was a little bit off mic and it just didn't, you know, sounded good in here, but out there it was like, oh, it's a little low. Let's see what else we can find. And that's versus 15, 20 alts that I've had to cut on stage before.
Yeah, yeah.
From, you know, getting it in more of that traditional way.
You have a really nice studio.
Thank
here,
you.
Here in your house. And a lot of high-end gear, and you've spent a lot of time, especially on the monitoring, mm-hmm. so you can hear really well. I'm curious. I've seen more and more post people put their own facilities in mm-hmm. home, and more people doing most of their work at home. Is this encouraged by Warner's? Do they care? Does it matter?
They're not I wouldn't say they're opposed to it completely. I think they encourage people to be on the lot, and they don't give you a gear rental, you know, for it. So it was more my choice because, what happened was, you know, they'd put me in a room, I'd be cutting something, and the guy next to me was working on sound effects at 120 SPL, and I couldn't hear anything. And yeah. The other thing too is what I don't like to cut on headphones. And I know a lot of dialogue editors cut on headphones. It's just too close. If you've got a good, you know, monitoring system, you should be able to hear what you're hearing even better. And I run it through my own little dialogue chain too, to boost the level, a little compression, you know, just to get a sense of how it's going to translate, you know, on stage. You know,
is that just in monitoring that you're doing that, or is?
Yeah, it's just, I just create a chain in my edit session that, you know, that does it. And that's the other thing. I mean, you know, with my background in mixing, you know, I kind of already have that ear for it, where a lot of dialogue editors, they don't have that experience.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so they don't necessarily know what's going to work, what a theater's going to be able to really do.
Yeah.
So I have a little bit more of an advantage, you know, on that. So, you know, but yeah, it was just impossible to cut dialogue next to somebody who's blasting something.
It's pretty amazing the fact that you wouldn't have isolation. You expect that from Warner Brothers.
Yeah,
have better studios.
I think, you know, over the years, it's like that, you know, the buildings are a lot older and, you know, they have newer rooms, but, you know, the old building 135 by the water tower, just with the walls were paper thin, you know, you could hear, you know, somebody cutting gunshots, at, you know, three doors down.
Yeah. But you're right. A lot of these buildings, they on the lots, on the various lots,
yeah,
they date back to the 30s.
If they work, I think they might be trying to kind of use that old building as more of like supervisor's building and trying to put editors, you know, elsewhere. But I think too, with people being able to work at home, is just a lack of space. You know, and with, you know, Pro Tools, you know, going and allowing, you know, third-party hardware, it's allowed a lot of people to, you know, cut on their laptops, you know, and do it at home, as opposed to, you know, going into Warner Brothers. Because before, you know, a Pro Tool system was $12,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And people weren't going to spend the money on that, especially if they weren't getting a kit rental for it.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So.
And how about the gear that they have? They must have. Yeah. Do they keep up with everything, or is it
somewhat?
Does it happen in increments?
It happens in increments. Yeah. You know, usually features will get the newest stuff first, and then their older systems. Sometimes, if they're really old, they'll, you know, just upgrade everything else. But you know, they'll you know, they're up to 10, you know, 10.3.8, I think, and Pro Tools 10 or OSX 10.8.5.
Yeah.
You know, so they'll probably be on that for another year or so. I don't see 11 happening there.
Are there any other workstations used besides Pro Tools?
No.
Yeah, see that?
Pro Tools is just the standard. It's what everybody has.
If you don't live in L.A. or New York, it's really hard to understand that. Because there's so many other workstations that are so good, actually.
It's true.
But not necessarily for television and or post in general, you know.
Maybe
good for music, but they'll translate.
You know, if with it just being kind of the standard, you get used to the, you know, some of the just the workflow in Pro Tools just makes a lot more sense and it's quicker.
Yeah.
You know, and it you just can get through it because there's almost a super simplistic approach to it that you don't even really have to think about it.
Yeah.
You know, it just kind of, you know what it's going to do. There's no quirk that you have to four-step work around to make it work, you know, sort of thing. And then Pro Tools has its quirk like any DAW does, but, you know, I just think there's a lot less of them than a lot of the other ones because they put so much into it.
And it's pretty solid now.
Yeah, too, and so. It's been, I mean, I maybe, you know, I get a crash every once in a while, and it's usually opening a session, and it's probably a UAD plugin that didn't load properly. And then it'll just open it up. At least now, with Pro Tools, you don't have to reboot the computer.
Yeah, right.
You can just restart it,
right,
which is nice.
What are the differences between doing music and doing post? And what's similar and what isn't?
I think the similarities are, I would say, just in getting like performances from somebody shooting ADR, an actor shooting ADR, and getting performances and vocals. I found those two things, you know, very similar. And, you know, and recently getting back into music and, you know, producing vocals and stuff like that, I found that really translated well. And to me, directing the actors on the stage, and just in terms of their rhythm, inflections, pitch, and I've been able to get actually even better, you know, better delivery out of it just in that fact alone. So I think that was a good thing. The differences are, with television, you have a picture, you have a guide track, and you're pretty much, you're following that. And that's, you know, kind of what it is. With music, you know, it's like, I don't like the way that chord sounded. I don't like the way that guitar sounds. Let's redo this. Let's try this mic on this vocal. Let's try this compressor. I mean, there's so many options that you can go through. I mean, and, you know, you can spend weeks just, you know, micro editing and you'll think you have it, and then you go back to it a week later, and it's like, oh, let me just tweak this drum, and let me try this. So, you know, I think the deadlines, especially if you're doing it on your own, you know, become, there is none.
Yeah.
And, you know, you spend, you know, half your day just, you know, fiddling with stuff, and then...
And post deadlines are a big deal.
Yeah, because, you know, obviously if it doesn't air, then that's going to be a big problem for the network.
Yeah, sure.
Because they've sold ad time.
Yeah.
You know, so... But I mean, I think with post, it's a lot more straightforward. You know, you see what you see on screen. The only time it gets maybe a little bit more, you know, different and creative is when it's like you're building really complete sound design. Hmm. You know, like I just saw the movie Lucy on Sunday, the Luc Besson movie, and they have a whole lot of visuals of going through and the drug that's making her all smart and do all this stuff. So they had to create all these, you know, sound design stuff, and, you know, so that would be a little bit, you know, sort of a different thing. You know, and a little bit more similar, because again, with sound design, you can just play for days, you know, to make it something cool. And, you know, you never know. I mean, yeah, synths, you know, going out and recording stuff, I mean, I guess with the, you know, you do record, you know, I'll record props, I'll record backgrounds, you know, effects, and, you know, in any way, you know, I think I was at Disney World for one of the rap parties, and we're at one of the roller coasters, and it goes above your head, so I took out my iPhone and recorded it.
So one of the, I guess the biggest thing for anybody doing post is sync. And it's also one of the most deceiving things that can happen, because sometimes after a while, you'll look at something and it will seem like it's in sync, and then it won't be. And I've been caught many a time with that.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that?
Same thing. You know, you if something's out of sync, you generally see it and you're like, that looks out of sync, and you might, you know, delay it a frame, or, you know, advance it a frame, and then think it looks better. Then you go back to it, and it's like, wait a minute, that looks out of sync.
Yeah,
and then you
yeah.
move it back to its original position, and it's in sync. Your mind does funny things with sync, because it's really hard to see. I mean, you can see within a frame. Some people can if they're really good, but if you watch it over and over and over again and adjusting sync, you're going to get used to seeing it that way, even if it's out. And you're going to start, your mind is just going to think that it's in sync because you're trying to make it in sync. So you spend too much time on it, and then you go back to it and it's out of sync. You're like, how's that out of sync? And especially that's a lot of the case with ADR, because, you know, it's not the original performance. You know, they might say a syllable a little bit longer.
Yeah, right.
You know, their rhythm might not be, you know, right. And they're looking at the picture and they're trying to, and, you know, there are people who are really good at it and can nail it and it makes it really easy for you. And other people who are, don't quite get the rhythm, and you really have to kind of, like, you know, time compress and you know, expand, you know, syllables or words to get it all.
What do you use for that?
I just use the standard Pro Tools one.
Oh, okay.
It works great. You know, if you do a whole line too far, you know, you'll start to get a little grainy. So I'll do, you know, parts of words or a small part of a phrase to kind of get it in sync. But, you know, I'll go through all of it and then go back to the beginning and watch everything, just so that I don't get locked into thinking that it's right.
Yeah.
And there was actually one time, we were on stage and they, you know, because the projector on stage has a long throw, so they have to adjust the sync,
yeah.
you know, for that. But it's the same output that goes to the LCD TV that we watch on. And there was this one actress who, and she did a really good job, never done an ADR before, but she said her lines really fast in the original take, and so she had to do it again. And I got it, literally within the frame, and the TV was out by one frame, and everybody was like, that dialogue looks soft. And I'm like, it's dead on in sync. I know it is. And so I started looking at the TV with my other one eye, you know, kind of in between and the picture on the monitor, because the monitor has, you know, much better latency.
Yeah.
And I could see it go, you know, and so I knew the TV was late.
Yeah.
So we adjusted the TV and it was dead on.
Wow. Very cool. Well, it's good to know that even the big boys have the same problem.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know. But it's always good, you know, when you have, you know, other eyes on stage to kind of look at those things and, you know, let another set of eyes be the judge too.
Yeah.
So it's always good, but always try to get it there in sync.
Yeah. Is there a piece of gear that you rely on all the time that you'd have to have, or if you didn't have, it would make your life a lot harder?
Let's see. I would say, I mean, it would probably come down more to the software side of things from the post point of view, as opposed to the gear side, because, you know, like, you know, RX Advanced 3 is invaluable. What else? You know, that's the one I, you know, primarily use, and Pro Tools. I mean, those are the two really big things that if I had to go to another DAW, I'd probably go,
Well, it's a big deal to denoise stuff, so
yeah. And you know, yeah. And denoising too is, it's like it can be dangerous and in improper hands.
Yeah,
you know,
because you can go too far on it.
People can go too far and they don't realize that they're going too far.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I have used the headphones that they use, and they're like those, you know, $75 Sony ones, and it's like you really can't hear anything in those headphones.
Yeah.
So it's kind of makes me wonder why, you know, some things come to the stage when it's like, why did they do that? Or they don't hear, like, you know, a very distant director going, action.
Oh, yeah.
And that comes across a lot. You'll hear a lot of, you know, things like that. And like with this setup and with the speakers and the fact that I don't have anybody blowing things up in the next room, you know, I can listen to it at a really good, you know, volume at, you know, 85. It's not, you know, it's, right there without being, and I can hear all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I think even now with the crane song, I'm hearing stuff that I didn't hear before.
Yeah.
Just light differences in just the air.
That's the crane song, Avocet.
Monitoring system. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there one piece of business advice that you've learned or someone imparted to you along the way? That's the most important one.
In terms of like post-production or just anything
in the business?
Humility, be humble, don't argue with your clients, listen to what they have to say, it's their vision.
Yeah.
You know, if they're, even if they're wrong, you know, and I sometimes, and I've been guilty of it too, you know, when you're mixing, and it more comes down to like when you're on the mixing side of things, you know, because you spent all this time and you're thinking it sounds great and then they want to change it all. So you kind of get a little like, what's going on? What's wrong with this? And you know, why are they making me do this? And I've worked with, you know, mixers who can get a little grumbly when they're asked to change something. But, you know, after I kind of just kind of realized, it's like 95-97% of what I've done is staying. It's just a level thing. It's not, they're not asking for it to be completely redone, you know, or anything. So it's like, so they want a couple things changed. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, you know,
it's ultimately what they want. And that's what your job is, to make sure that they get what they want.
Yeah.
And with a smile.
Words of wisdom. It's a good place to start.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Jason.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bobby.
Very cool. If you want to find out more about Jason, go to wbsound.com/portfolio/Jason-Brennan, B-R-E-N-N-A-N. Or you can find him on LinkedIn. Just do a search there and you can find out a lot more about Jason. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. It's questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who puts the show together. He's the host of The Producer Podcast at theproducer.club. That's one word, theproducer.club, C-U-L-B. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up sheet for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. See you next time.